afternoon, and thank you all for holding. All participants will be able to listen only until the question and answer session of today's call, at which time, if you'd like to ask a question, you can press star followed by one on your touch-tone phone. You will be prompted to record your name prior to asking your question. Also, today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to your first speaker today, Chris Cosmos. You may begin.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Chris Cosmos. I'm the director of the Division of State and Local Readiness and also the lead for the State Coordination Task Force here at CDC and our Incident Command Structure. So as you know, this is the fourth of a series of six teleconferences that we have planned for you to follow up on the topics that we discussed during the April 1st Zika Action Plan or the ZAP Summit here at CDC. Now, during the ZAP Summit, we got a lot of feedback from participants, not only on the summit, but also on some of the remaining challenges and issues that you would like to hear more about so that you can continue to finalize your plans at the state and local level. So as we looked at some of that data that came from the ZAP Summit, we developed our teleconferences to be able to address some of those concepts and challenges that you brought up during the summit. So today we're going to focus on one of the topics that was really kind of a hot topic during the summer or during the summit, and we're going to focus on sexual transmission and pregnancy planning. And we have two of our great experts here from CDC. You're going to hear from Dr. Dana Meany-Delman, who's the clinical team lead on CDC's Pregnancy and Birth Defects Task Force for the Zika response. Dr. Meany-Delman is also the senior medical advisor in CDC's National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. And you're also going to hear from Dr. John Brooks, who's the senior medical advisor for the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention in CDC's National Center for HIV, Hepatitis, TB, and STD Prevention. Both Dana and John are working on the Zika response and also worked on the Ebola response, so they are well known in CDC's incident command structure. Before we get started today, I want to remind you of the two upcoming topics that we have also planned for you to kind of round out the series of six. June 8th is going to be our epidemiology follow-up ZAP Summit. That's from 2 to 3 Eastern Time, and we've sent out information on that. And on June 13th, which is a Monday, will be the last in the series of six. That is the diagnostics, the lab capacity, and testing interpretation. That's going to be from 1 to 2 o'clock Eastern Time. So the other thing that I want to remind all of you is that this presentation is intended for public health professionals. If there are any media people, any reporters on today's line, you are asked to disconnect at this time. And if you have any questions about any of this content, you can contact the CDC media office for further information, but this call is strictly for our public health professional partners. Now, the other thing that I just wanted to mention as well before we get started is that if there are any remaining issues that you feel like we didn't quite hit the mark on or that we need more information or add another teleconference onto this series of six, we'd be happy to hear about any suggestions that you may have in terms of continuing this series. And you can let us know that by emailing us at preparedness@cdc.gov. And if you have any success stories that you'd like to share, we're always happy to hear the good news as well as what you consider to be the remaining challenges. All right. So with that, I am going to turn it over to John Brooks, and he's going to start off today's conference and conversation. John?
Chris, thank you, and good afternoon, everybody, and good morning, I suppose, or to some of you who may be on the West Coast or further west. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak to you today about this topic, and over the next 20 minutes or so, I'd like to go through some slides, and I'll tell you when to progress to the next one, about what we know about prevention of sexually transmitted Zika. So I'm going to move on to the first slide. It shows our objectives, which in brief are to review what is known and what is not known, that's an important area, about sexual transmission of Zika virus, and then describe some of our activities, materials, and resources that are available to you all as well as clinicians and consumers, and then identify at the end what states and local programs can do to help us reduce the risk of sexual transmission of Zika. So moving on to the next slide is a picture of an Aedes aegypti mosquito on here, and I just wanted to remind folks of what we know in terms of how Zika can be transmitted. It's been well documented that the bite of both the Aedes aegypti as well as the Aedes albopictus mosquito can transmit the virus. There's also good evidence that the virus can be transmitted mother to child, either in utero or during birth perinatally. And lastly, that the virus can be transmitted sexually and only from men to their male or female sex partners. I'll talk about that, of course, a little bit more. That's the topic of this section. I also wanted to point out that it's plausible that the virus could be transmitted by the other routes I've listed here. None have yet been demonstrated to have transmitted the virus, but, of course, we're concerned about the possibility, and different groups at CDC are addressing prevention recommendations in those areas. I'll move on to the next slide, then, that shows a map that may be familiar, two maps, actually, that may be familiar to many of you, and it's just to remind you of what the anticipated estimated, and I put that in large quotation marks, estimated range of these mosquitoes is in the United States, and where, therefore, Zika could be transmitted person to person if it arrived there. This sexual transmission could occur anywhere, but these are areas within the United States that were a traveler to come from that area with Zika and go to an area without it. Sexual transmission may occur outside of an area where these mosquitoes are present. Indeed, those are the cases we've only been seeing in the United States so far. That is, among people who have acquired Zika sexually, it has been from a man who traveled to an endemic area, acquired the infection there, then brought it home and transmitted it to his sexual partner, who was at the time living in an area without mosquito activity or known endemic local Zika transmission. Moving to the next slide, then, I do want to reiterate what's really the top of our concern with Zika here, which is pregnant women. We know that women can be infected at conception or during pregnancy, and I think Dana will speak a little bit more about that. And, of course, our biggest concern is the threat to the developing fetus in terms of risk for microcephaly and other severe fetal brain and nervous system defects. I just want to point out that there are a lot of women of reproductive age in the United States, and that of women aged 14 to 55 in that group, 37% of the time when they become pregnant, it was unplanned. So we make a lot of recommendations for reducing sexual transmission to pregnant women, but I want to also reiterate that there is a population of women who are sexually active and may not anticipate that they could become pregnant, and if they were pregnant at the time they were exposed to Zika, then their fetus could be exposed. Next slide, then, I want to review in three slides sort of what we know and balanced against it what we don't know about sexual transmission of Zika. So I think the first important point I want to make is that there are case-level data that have shown us that Zika can be found in a man's semen longer than in his blood. All of the data I'm talking about right now with regard to sexual transmission is limited to case reports. I'll talk about some studies we're doing later to try and get more information about this risk. But like the early days of HIV, for those of you who remember it, or other conditions where, you know, we were just learning about it, a lot of it right now, at least for this particular problem, is at the level of case reports. But we know it can definitely be found in semen longer than a guy's blood. How long it can stay in semen, we don't know. It has been detected by culture in semen up to 24 days after a man first developed symptoms of infection, and the virus particles have been detected by reverse transcriptase PCR up to 62 days after a man first developed symptoms. Importantly, we also don't know the pattern or the frequency of shedding in the semen. For instance, whether it's intermittent, so some days a guy may shed it in his semen, the next day he doesn't, or if it declines steadily. And if it does decline, then how does it decline? Is it a straight line, or is it a fast drop-off, or is it logarithmic? That's what we're hoping some of these studies will help us elucidate. And we also don't know if Zika can be spread from other body fluids that are exchanged during sex, importantly, saliva and vaginal fluids. Next slide. Then number two, we know that Zika can be spread through sex by a man who has the virus to his male and female partners through vaginal, anal, and oral sex. And when we speak about oral sex, we're speaking about fellatio or mouth-to-penis sex. We don't have information about mouth-to-vagina sex or cunnilingus. And that's why we don't know if women with Zika can spread the virus to their sex partners. But to date, we've had no case reports of transmissions like that, and we've tried to alert people, as I hope you all are looking for them as well, alert our colleagues in the clinical area to report such a case if it were to occur. But right now, all the evidence we have available suggests that the virus is spread from men sexually to their male or female sex partners. And then lastly, next slide, in all known cases of sexual transmission, the men developed Zika symptoms. That is to say, we haven't had a sexual transmission yet documented either here in the U.S. or elsewhere in the world where the transmission occurred from a man who had Zika but no symptoms to a male or female sexual partner. And so the reason we're concerned about that, of course, is that in Zika virus infection, up to 80% of persons who are infected may have no symptoms. And so we are concerned about men who may be asymptomatically infected and the risk they pose. In addition, men have transmitted the virus shortly before they develop symptoms, of course, while they've had symptoms, and it's been documented they've transmitted after symptoms have developed. What we don't know is whether, as I mentioned, whether asymptomatic men can have Zika in their semen and then transmit it to their partners during sex. And we don't know whether we know anything at all about asymptomatic men with regard to the frequency, duration, or pattern of shedding, the same way we don't know that in symptomatically infected men. The next slide, that sort of summarizes what we know and don't know. A lot of that is summarized in the guidance I've highlighted here. This appeared April 1st, and we will update it as more information comes in. To date, we haven't got a lot of new information that really merits updating these the recommendations we made in this document, which I'd like to review the basics with you now. So on the next slide, our recommendations assessed a number of risk groups. Of course, top of the line are pregnant women and their male sex partners. But we also had guidance related to other groups of concerned couples, couples who are trying to conceive and whose main concern may be reducing the risk of exposing a developing fetus to the virus, as well as couples who may not be trying to conceive. There are couples who may be very concerned just about getting Zika because they don't want to get sick with Zika, or they're worried that even though they're not trying to conceive, they may have an unintended pregnancy and want to take precautions. And so we have advice for all three of these groups. And let me start with the first group. That's the next slide, recommendations for pregnant women and their male sex partners. This advice applies to couples in which the man has traveled to or resides in an area with active Zika virus transmission. And for couples in which the woman is pregnant, we recommend couples use condoms consistently and correctly for all vaginal, anal, or oral sex, or abstain from vaginal, anal, and oral sex for the duration of the pregnancy. And this remains our very strongest recommendation, and it does not change based on whether the woman lives in an area affected by Zika, has a male partner who travels to or lives in a Zika-affected area, or whether the male partner has symptoms or if he tests positive or negative for Zika. It's based on the point here is that it's based on the exposure alone until evidence is provided that will cause us to recommend otherwise. Moving on to the next slide, there's a table here. It's a little complex. This is available on the web at the address at the bottom left-hand corner of the slide. But this is advice to couples who are trying to conceive. So these are couples who want to reduce the risk of potentially exposing a fetus if they become pregnant. So basically the question is, how long do I have to wait to attempt conception if I'm worried about possibly having Zika? And for in a situation where the man has traveled to an area with Zika or is coming from an area where he's living or is coming from an area where Zika is endemic, if the either the man or the woman, so this, I'm sorry, I should clarify, this also applies to women who are returning from an area where Zika may be present. If either the man or the woman has symptoms of Zika, they should either use condoms or abstain from sex after symptoms start for at least 8 weeks in the case of the woman, 6 weeks in the case of the man. Why the difference? I'll talk about it shortly, but we think that in the woman, there we have no evidence there's a persistent reservoir for Zika in a woman. So if she's had Zika, we believe that after 8 weeks, it's very likely that she will have cleared the virus and not herself pose a risk for transmitting it to a fetus if she becomes pregnant. In the case of a man, however, after symptoms, we recommend a longer span to account for this possibility that it may be present in the semen for some time after symptoms develop. In the case neither person has symptoms, we recommend at least 8 weeks for both partners, and the man may want to speak to his healthcare, his doctor or any other healthcare provider about exposures to kind of get a better sense of what the potential risk is to the man. You know, where was he traveling? Was he using insect repellent? How much time did he spend in the area? Were mosquitoes seen, or does he remember getting bitten by a mosquito? Same advice for people living in an area with Zika applies to those who develop symptoms. So, again, if you're living in an area with Zika and you develop symptoms and you're a woman, we would recommend waiting 8 weeks. And if you're a man and you have developed symptoms of Zika, wait at least 6 months. It's much more complicated if you don't have symptoms. You know, that's going to have to be a very nuanced, individual discussion for a couple living in the area, reviewing what their wishes and concerns are, what the potential exposures are. And so we recommend in that case you really need to talk to a doctor or healthcare provider if you want more individualized recommendations on what to do in terms of conception. Now let me move to the next slide where we talk to couples who are not concerned about pregnancy. So again, in the case where the man has traveled to an area with Zika, or a woman has sex with a man who's been in an area of Zika, or again, a woman herself may have traveled and returns from an area with Zika. Since there's no known risk of a woman transmitting to a man, at least for women in this situation, whether symptomatic or not, we don't know risk of sexual transmission to sex partners, but she definitely should assess the risk of acquiring Zika from her male sex partners. For the man, however, there is this possibility that the virus could be present in semen for a period of time, and if symptomatic, we'd recommend waiting 6 months and using condoms or abstaining during that time, or if asymptomatic, 8 weeks. Likewise, for persons living in areas of active Zika transmission, we're not worried about a woman transmitting to a man, again, because of there's no known risk of transmission from a woman to a man, but she should assess the likelihood that her male sexual partners may transmit to her, and men who are concerned and women and couples who are concerned should use condoms and abstain for at least 6 months if the man's been symptomatic. And then a discussion here, if they really want to reduce the risk of transmitting and they're living in an endemic area, then we would recommend using condoms or abstaining until the Zika is no longer in the area or until the area is declared free of Zika. I presented these time frames. Let me go over a little bit about how they were derived, because I think that's important for folks to understand. And the first point here is that we used what we thought was a conservative approach. We recognize that the exact incubation period of Zika is unknown, but we have some good data from case reports and people who've been infected. The duration of Zika persistence in semen is definitely not fully known, but again, we have some point that we can triangulate with. And we recognize that even though we want to be very conservative, there are couples seeking to achieve conception, so we really do need to provide some guidance, at least with regard to time frames, to help folks in that situation. So how do we arrive at the 8-week recommendation? So this is for a situation where persistence is not known to be a concern. So in a woman who's been infected, and also we believe in an asymptomatic man who doesn't develop symptoms of Zika but may have traveled to an area with active transmission. And essentially what we did was we took the upper limit of the known incubation period, which was 14 days. We added 3 times the longest period of viremia, a period of time the person may actually have virus in their blood, that was 33 days. And then we added additional time for variability in how individuals respond immunologically to control and eliminate the infection. Essentially we came up with 8 weeks, and that's got a good buffer of extra time in it. 6 months This is for a situation where persistence is known to be a concern. That is where a man may potentially have virus in the semen that he could transmit. And to get this number, we took a conservative approach, saying we're going to use that 62-day time point where virus particles were detected in the semen, multiply that by 3, add a little bit of time, and you get to 6 months. Moving on to the next slide. So I talked about these time frames. Of course, the question of testing comes up very frequently. Who should be tested? Right now, CDC recommends testing to establish the diagnosis of infection. We do not recommend testing to establish risk of sexual transmission, and I'm going to talk about that more on the next slide. Testing right now is recommended for the purpose of establishing a diagnosis. Who should be tested? Either persons who present with Zika symptoms or pregnant women, whether symptomatic or asymptomatic. And under what circumstances? If people in those first two categories have either traveled to or live in an area with Zika or had sex with a man who has been in an area with Zika. The only exception is the case where a couple where a traveler returns from an area of active Zika transmission and his sexual partner may have been exposed, but neither of them develop symptoms. That's the one case where testing is not recommended. Next slide. So as I noted, testing is not recommended to establish risk of sexual transmission in men until we know more about Zika shedding in semen. The problem we're working with here is we don't know enough to really know how to interpret these data. You know, a negative result could be falsely reassuring. First, since Zika can persist in semen after it's no longer detectable by reverse transcriptase PCR in the blood. So, for instance, a negative serum or blood IgM test could represent a falsely negative test. The test didn't perform correctly. That's a possibility. Or the man could have been tested before IgM had developed in his blood or later after an infection when it had already waned. So there may be the possibility that there aren't antibodies in the blood anymore, but there could still be virus in the semen. We just don't know how those two mesh up yet together. And we also don't recommend testing semen, either by RT-PCR or culture, because a negative test may just be a result of intermittent shedding. You may recall I mentioned we just don't know the pattern of shedding, and there are other STDs which do shed intermittently. Of course, every bacteria, every virus, and every infection is sort of its own thing, but there are examples of things that have been transmitted, especially where the shedding is intermittent, and we'd like to find out if that's a possibility here. Further, the testing of semen has not been validated. That doesn't mean there aren't labs that are doing it, and some labs have pulled together technology to do it and reporting out the results, but it hasn't been standardized and isn't presently. There isn't an FDA-approved method for the indication. So just a little bit about sperm and oocyte donation. In the next slide, I will say that sperm and egg donation is very closely regulated by the FDA, and the FDA has published guidance and put into place guidance that will design to prevent transmission of Zika from gametes, either sperm or oocytes. Important to know is that directed donations, that is between two individuals, and I'm going to share my sperm with someone or give my egg to someone or receive sperm or egg from someone, those kind of directed donations may not be covered by FDA guidance in some select circumstances. I don't want to go into the details now, that you can go and read about it, but the important point I think here is that it's really incumbent on our community of providers who see these couples to review the risks and benefits with those patients. And for any person who is considering sperm or egg donation, any kind of assisted reproduction who has concerns, definitely they are welcome and able to contact the entity that's providing those gametes and inquire about their policies. What are they doing to make sure that the material that I may be using is as possibly free of Zika as is reasonable? You may want to know more about the donor, consider their risk with regard to travel history and symptoms, and so that you can make the most informed choice. And, of course, there's always the possibility of simply waiting if you can. So there may be couples who are able to wait until a donor, for instance, has reached the 8-week or 6-month limit where we think it's probably safe to donate. I will note, however, that testing of egg and sperm donors is not recommended at present, again, like for sexual transmission, because of the possibility of falsely reassuring negative results. We really want to make sure that if a person tests negative, we know they're really negative, and our understanding of how to interpret the testing in this area is still evolving. Moving on to the next slide, I just want to share some challenges that you face when talking about sexual transmission with folks. I think, first of all, talking about sexual transmission of Zika can be very complicated, and some points to help you. Many of you know this, but I'm going to repeat some of it anyway. Use clear and unambiguous language and instructions, and make it very clear to couples that if they're concerned about Zika, the only choices that we're aware of now to reduce that risk of transmission sexually is to use condoms or choose not to have sex, and that we highly recommend this for couples where pregnancy is present. And to be effective, condoms must be used correctly from start to finish every time during sex. Believe it or not, there are people who still have trouble managing how to put on and take off a condom correctly, and we have now instructions with pictures to help on our website. There'll be a link to it later. I'll show you that folks can go to, and we soon hope to have products up that you can download, print, and share in the form of palm cards or even handouts or fact sheets with people. And be clear that sex includes vaginal, anal, and oral sex. Now, couples who don't desire pregnancy, and this is what Dana is going to talk about shortly, should use the most effective contraceptive method that they can, use it correctly and consistently in addition to condoms, because we don't want them to, for instance, use the birth control pill or IUD and then still be exposed to Zika. They got to use the condom, the barrier method, to prevent that exposure, because the semen can transmit Zika, and of course, it reduces your risk for other STDs as well. Next slide. I mentioned condom skills is an important challenge. Practice almost always makes perfect, but it's tricky. And you need to use proper lubricant with condoms so that they don't rip or tear. And just a reminder for those of you not familiar that with condoms in the United States, we recommend water and silicone-based lubricants, not oil-based. No baby oil, butter, hand lotion, that kind of thing. There may be challenges with availability and access to condoms. They're not always free. People have difficulty affording them. And, of course, it may be difficult in a couple for one partner to convince the other to use condoms. And there are, of course, the issues around social norms and religious beliefs. There are certainly plenty of people in our country and elsewhere where religious and cultural beliefs may make it difficult to restrict the person's ability to use condoms or other forms of contraception. So just some things to keep in mind. Next slide. What are we doing to better understand here at CDC, the shedding of Zika virus in semen or other body fluids? We have two studies underway. We're not the only country doing studies. I know the Brazilians are doing some studies as well in this area. The first study that I want to mention is one for folks in the United States. It's a U.S. study aimed at enrolling returned male travelers who've been diagnosed with Zika. In this study, volunteers provide serum and urine every 2 weeks for up to 6 months after their symptom onset. This is managed out of our facility at Fort Collins, Colorado. The important step is that the state or local health department recognize the man who has Zika and then make the referral to the study coordinator, who is Allison Hinckley, and her contact information is here. And then from the Fort Collins centralized location, they will send out a box with all the materials you need to self-collect the specimens and then mail it back. And so once enrolled, it can be managed kind of indirectly. There's also a study going on in Puerto Rico of both men and women who've been diagnosed with Zika called the Zipper. In this study, from both men and women, they're collecting blood, saliva, and urine. And then from men, also semen. And from women, also vaginal secretions, testing every 2 weeks. Here, they're not just enrolling symptomatic persons, but they're also identifying persons in the household who may have been asymptomatically infected, to also try and collect specimens from them. Again, specimens are collected for a period of time, in this case weekly for four weeks and biweekly until each respective specimen is negative twice, and they're trying to get 350 patients with up to 5 household contacts each. If you want more information about this, write Zipper, but that's 1P, Z-I-P-E-R, at cdc.gov. Next slide. Case reports really matter. Those of you who have a suspect case, please get in touch with us as soon as you can. We'd really like to know as much as we can about cases until we have more information. This is our real source. Timely reporting not only increases the opportunity for us to potentially collect relevant samples from willing male volunteers to kind of hone in on those time frames of how long it persists in semen and what the pattern might be, but it also means that if there is something important, we could manage changes in our recommendations faster and protect people appropriately. Next slide. So what can you do? Well, first, communicate about sexual risk and how to prevent sexual transmission within your own communities and to the audiences that you speak to. Make condoms available and accessible. We recommend that as part of planning to that you assess potential demand and current stock of condoms in the jurisdiction that you serve and prepare a plan to acquire, distribute, and promote condom use if they're needed. Provide resources information for pregnancy prevention, and of course, refer cases of infected men to the U.S. viral persistence study I mentioned before. Next slide, I just want to highlight, you can come back to this slide at any time. These are links to various sources for fact sheets, posters, infographics, including an infographic on how to use a male condom, and the top link to our sexual transmission webpage will contain the latest information. Next slide, towards the end here for reference, are links to some of our guidelines, so you have that handy if you want to go back. And I'll stop there in the next slide and thank you and turn it over to Dana.
Thanks so much, John. Hopefully there you can bring up the slide set. I'm going to focus today on the importance of pregnancy planning in areas with active Zika virus transmission. So we've talked a lot about how to prevent Zika virus, but one of the primary strategies to reduce Zika-related pregnancy complications is to prevent pregnancy in women who want to delay or avoid pregnancy. And along these lines, there are several important aspects. The first is to discuss the prevention of unintended pregnancy with women and couples who live in areas with local Zika virus transmission and who want to delay or avoid becoming pregnant, and to provide information on birth control methods that best meet their needs, including long-active reversible contraceptives. You know, the next slide, please. So John has already referenced some of the material that was published on March 25th. These were interim guidelines for healthcare providers caring for women of reproductive age with possible Zika virus exposure. On the next slide, you can see John, similar to what John has presented, the recommendations that John went through for couples interested in conceiving, and we've outlined the various time frames for both men and women. What we've also done, if you go to the next slide, what we've also done is outline what are the important aspects when counseling individuals and couples that are interested in conceiving in areas with active Zika virus transmission. And this includes factoring in all of the aspects that go into a decision about conceiving in the setting of active Zika virus transmission. The first is a reproductive life plan. So this refers to where the couple is in terms of their desires to achieve fertility. It takes factors into consideration like age, number of children, and fertility. So those are all important aspects that go into a decision when a healthcare provider is counseling a couple that may be interested in conceiving when active Zika transmission is occurring. The other piece is the environmental risk of exposure. So where is the active Zika virus transmission, and is there a likely exposure that will occur? And this may vary according to where someone lives. And then personal measures to prevent mosquito bites. So this should be for anyone in an area with active Zika virus transmission, but particularly for couples who are interested in conceiving, it's important that both the male and the female would be preventing mosquito bites. Personal measures to prevent sexual transmission, and then education about what does Zika virus infection do? What are the effects on pregnant women and fetuses? What is the risk to a pregnancy that is affected by Zika virus infection? And then the risks and benefits of pregnancy that should go into any preconception counseling, and this factors in things like medical history and risks that are inherent to the pregnancy itself, not just Zika virus infection. On the next slide, you'll find a clinical tool that CDC has put together, which is a preconception counseling tool for men and women who are living in areas with ongoing spread of Zika virus who are interested in conceiving. And what this outlines is some of the factors described on the slide before, and outlines for healthcare providers what specific questions they should ask and provides a sample script that they can use when discussing issues of conception and periconception with patients. And this is, we found from talking with colleagues in the healthcare community, this has been a highly effective tool that providers are using in their offices, and some health departments are using as well. And this is available on our website. On the next slide, you'll find recommendations for couples interested in conceiving, and it's important to emphasize prevention of mosquito bites, particularly the use of EPA-registered insect repellents. And there's been some concern about use of insect repellents, but this is critical for individuals who are trying to conceive or for women who are pregnant. In addition, some of the strategies that are relevant here include wearing long sleeve pants, wearing long sleeves and pants, as well as removing standing water and some of the other environmental things that we know are effective in terms of preventing mosquito exposure. And I think John has already touched on preventing sexual transmission through correct and consistent use of condoms or abstaining of sex during pregnancy. So these would all be conversations that healthcare providers would have with couples. Next slide, please. Recommendations for couples interested in conceiving, if one or both members of the couple have Zika virus disease, as we've described, we'd recommend waiting to attempt conception, and John's outlined these time frames clearly on his presentation. On the next slide, we talk about if couples are waiting to conceive, that they really need to understand the strategies to prevent unintended pregnancy. And I think it's really important that we emphasize that some strategies to prevent unintended pregnancy are better than others. We want to ensure that the most effective contraceptive methods can be used correctly and consistently, because there are differences not only in the efficacy of contraception, but also in the ability to use contraceptive correctly and consistently. And as John mentioned, the correct and consistent use of condoms is important to emphasize in addition to contraceptive use because of the risk of sexual exposure. So you'll find on the next slide we have projected an image that is available on our website, which describes the most effective family planning methods. And in the very top box, you'll see the most effective methods for preventing pregnancy. These include implants, intrauterine devices, as well as sterilization, both male and female. And the percentages are the failure risk in a year for a typical user. And so the most effective methods are those that require very little remembering of the use of a contraception. Next slide. On the next box, you'll see this is where some of our most common contraceptives that are used in the United States, the pill, for example, are listed. And you'll see here, even for the birth control pill, typical use results in a 9% failure rate. And as we go down the slide, there are less effective contraceptives. And these, of course, require more use on the provider's, on the individual's part. If you go to the next slide, what is the contraceptive access in the United States and how does this impact and overlap with Zika virus infection? So to set this all in context, the unintended pregnancy rates in the United States vary by region. And what we've done on this slide is indicated where these states are, what the unintended pregnancy rates are in these states, and overlaid them with the mosquito maps that you've seen from John earlier. And so it's important that we focus efforts on where unintended pregnancy rates are highest in the U.S. Next slide. Contraceptive access in the U.S. has been studied and continues to be studied. We know there are 61 million women in the U.S. who are of reproductive age, and among those, 43 million are at risk for unintended pregnancy. Of those, approximately 62% currently use a contraceptive method, and about 10% are currently using a long-acting reversible contraceptive, that is, an IUD or an implant. These are are considered highly effective methods of contraception. Overall, approximately 10% of women who are at risk for an unintended pregnancy are not currently using any contraceptive method. On the next slide, you'll find that the most common contraceptive methods used in the U.S. are the birth control pill, female sterilization, and male condoms. And you can see those percentages represented here. As I described earlier, we know that the birth control pill has approximately 9% failure rate for typical users in a year, and that male condoms have an approximately 8% failure rate for the typical user in a year. Next slide. So in terms of contraceptive needs in the U.S., we know there still is a significant unmet contraceptive need. Approximately 20 million women at risk for unintended pregnancy were in need of publicly funded contraceptive services, according to a study done by Guttmacher Institute. And these are defined as women who have an income level that's less than 250% of the federal poverty level, or women who are less than 20 years of age. And of these, approximately 5.6 million did not have health insurance, and publicly funded providers met only approximately 14% of the need. So this means that many U.S. women are still at risk for unintended pregnancy. On the next slide, you'll find that the CDC has compiled fact sheets for each state regarding resources for efforts targeting unintended pregnancy. And so on this link here on the upper right are links to these fact sheets by state, which outline the various unintended pregnancy initiatives that are available within each state, and I'll walk through each one of them. So on the next slide, the 6 and 18 initiative is a partnership between CDC, healthcare purchasers, payers, and providers to accelerate adoption of evidence-based prevention interventions. And this targets the adoption of 18 proven interventions for 6 common and costly health conditions, including unintended pregnancy. The second is a CDC ASTO Immediate Postpartum LARC Learning Community, which is a collaboration between states with states to assist state health agencies in implementing long-acting reversible contraceptives. On the next slide is the Collaborative Improvement and Innovation Network to reduce infant mortality, pre- and interconception care. And a key strategy to improve preconception and interconception care includes the delivery of contraceptive services to prevent teen and unintended pregnancy and to improve birth spacing. And then lastly, on the next slide is the Center for Medicaid and CHIP Services Maternal and Infant Health Initiative. And this promotes timely and comprehensive postpartum care, including promotion of pregnancy planning and spacing and prevention of unintended pregnancies through increased use of effective contraception. So what is CDC doing? On the next slide, you'll find that we are assessing access to contraception through several ongoing efforts. We are analyzing data from the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, which is a surveillance project of CDC and state health departments that collects state-specific population-based data on maternal attitudes, experiences before, during, and shortly after birth, and this assesses unintended pregnancy and postpartum contraceptive use. In addition, we are planning a comprehensive assessment of contraceptive services and unintended pregnancy in states and territories. We're also undergoing efforts to improve access to contraceptive services in the continental U.S. And the HHS strategy is a three-pronged approach to increasing contraceptive access. The first is to expand access to contraceptive services. The second is to eliminate barriers to reimbursement. And the third is to increase awareness and training of contraceptive methods and counseling to providers. So CDC is actively collaborating with HHS agencies to remove barriers and to increase contraceptive access for women who want to delay or avoid pregnancy during Zika. And you can see several of our collaborative efforts listed here on this slide. On the next slide, we talked briefly about CDC's efforts to encourage state Medicaid programs to implement LARC payment strategies. This aligns with the HHS three-pronged strategy, which includes eliminating barriers to reimbursement, as well as strengthening the capacity of providers to deliver contraceptive services by ensuring that providers are well-trained, particularly on long-acting reversible contraceptives. Next slide. So what can you do to promote contraceptive access and pregnancy planning in the context of Zika? The first is prior to local transmission, so this is now, educate providers about the importance of discussing contraception with women and couples who live in areas that may be at risk for local transmission. To assess the availability of contraceptive access for women of reproductive age in your jurisdiction, and to identify geographic areas or vulnerable populations who may not currently have access to contraceptive services. On the next slide, there are some strategies here listed for when local transmission does occur. This will include informing providers about the importance of discussing contraception, recommending that providers ensure that couples who want to delay or avoid pregnancy are informed about birth control methods that best meet their needs, including long-acting reversible contraceptives, and that there are plans in place to ensure contraceptive access is available for underserved populations. And on the next series of slides are some resources and information for women, as well as resources and information for providers that hopefully will be helpful to ascertain what information is needed for both of these groups. And with that, I will open it up to questions and invite John to join me.
Thank you. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your touch-tone phone. You will be prompted to record your name prior to asking your question. To withdraw your question, you may press star two. Again, that's star one to ask a question. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Mary McIntyre. Your line is open.
Yes. And this question is really directed to Drs. Brooks and Dalman. It's related to the ages listed in the slides as far as the, I think, Dr. Brooks, you indicated 14 to 55 years old, and Dr. Dalman, I think you had 15 to 44 years old. Is there a reason for the differences in those ages listed as reproductive?
Well, this is I can respond first, Dana, just quickly. This is John. You know, different studies where the data come from choose sometimes somewhat different age groups, you know, that they're looking at. It's not uncommon to have them differ by a year or two, but I think the key point is that women in that age group of middle adolescence up into their mid-40s is the one that we worry about. I don't think that the addition or deletion of a year on one end would really change the data substantively that were presented.
The issue is by it's almost 11 years. And maybe was that a typo?
Oh, I'm not sure. Let's see.
It was 44 years, and then on the other one, it was 55.
So I think the bigger question is, what is, in general, the age of childbearing?
Yes. What should we be focusing? What group should we be focusing on?
Well, in general, when we think about contraceptive access and reproductive age women, we think about ages 15 to 44 being the highest risk group that we need to ensure have contraceptive access. Some studies, as John mentioned, may include additional folks on either end of that spectrum, but that's the main target group for the 15 to 44-year-olds.
And Mary, I'll just say thank you for bringing that to our attention. I'm going to go back and check and make sure it's not a typo.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Michaela Harris. Your line is open.
Hello. I'm just looking at the resources regarding the preconception planning. Do you know if there's any that specifically have the Zika virus information on the preconception facts?
So you mean specific to Zika, not the tool that I showed in the slides? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, just handouts that has the preconception information with or the preconception info along with the Zika virus information.
Right. So we're developing one specifically for patients. We've had some requests from healthcare providers that we develop a tool that can be provided to patients by healthcare providers in their offices. So that is in progress.
It's in progress? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Beth Bellin, your line is open.
Hi, thank you. For women that traveled in 2015 and then became pregnant later in the year, what kind of risk is there for them?
So, what we are concerned about is Zika virus in the periconception period. For individuals who have traveled and have had a remote exposure, we're not concerned about future pregnancies.
Thank you.
And Dana, I might just add that to the best of our knowledge, once you've had Zika, as far as we know, you appear to be immune for life at the present time.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the Ohio Department of Health. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for taking the question. Given the large number of individuals who may not have symptoms and may not be able to recognize the necessity to take precautions or may not, because of the lack of symptoms, engage the information that's out there, I guess one of the questions we've had is some alternative ways to reach those who are traveling. I don't know if you guys are the right ones to answer or not, but we wanted to pass it on. Have you considered a national outreach to travel groups like Expedia or Kayak or the airlines to provide a pop-up for those who are traveling to Zika-affected countries to help them to engage the information that's available, especially with sexual transmission, so they can take precautions when they're returning?
Thank you. This is John. It's a great question. It actually isn't specifically within our wheelhouse, but we communicate very closely with our colleagues in the Division of Global Migration and Quarantine and others who cover travelers. Now, I want to bring that to their attention. We've been actually corresponding with them pretty regularly about how can we raise awareness about sexual transmission among travelers, I think for the really good reasons that you point out. And those are some good creative ideas, and you're welcome to send them in. I don't know if my email address was on there, but you can use zud4@cdc.gov if you want. That's zebra uniform delta at cdc.gov. Zebra uniform delta, the numeral 4, at cdc.gov.
Thanks, John. We'll send it in.
Thank you. Pamela Ayala, your line is open.
Pamela?
The people that donate sperm and it is frozen for future donation, are you seeing any type of decrease of activity in the Zika virus once it is frozen?
Well, that's a good question. So we actually freeze the virus down to store it and then in the laboratory and then thaw it out so we can use it. So freezing doesn't kill the virus, if that's the question you're asking about. In terms of stored specimens, at most sperm donation centers, I don't want to speak, or facilities that collect and provide sperm, I don't want to speak for all of them, but many of them collect travel history on their clients and the national organizations that cover those centers, I think, in collaboration with FDA, are going back and looking at travel histories and kind of pulling out and tossing those where a person might have been at risk due to travel. So people are very concerned about that possibility and are working to address it.
Thank you. Marlene Allison, your line is open.
Yes, I wanted to know if you have like an educational video that we could show in, the waiting room.
On what topic?
About the Zika. Hello?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I can say that for sexual transmission, I'm not sure we have one. I really don't know all of the resources completely. I don't know, Dana, do you all have any about conception or protecting the baby?
So we have several Medscape videos that we've done that are available online. I guess I'm not sure if they would be appropriate for a waiting room. I mean, they may be a little they may have a little bit too much medical jargon.
Yeah.
There is a Zika 101, or what is Zika, video that is available on the Zika virus website. It's Dr. Ann Schuchat's video that may be a little bit more broad, but would be more for a audience in a waiting room, I would say.
That's what I was thinking more of, some kind of educational video, to teach the public more about the Zika virus, how it's transmitted, and how they can protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And also you mentioned about insect repellent during pregnancy. Do you know how safe it is to be using during pregnancy?
Right, so on our website, we talk about the various insect repellents and encourage that they're used in accordance with the EPA guidelines, which are listed on these insect repellents. We encourage the use of DEET, picarin, and some of the others that are listed on our website. But this question has come up quite a bit, and, when we are looking at the risk to pregnant women, it's clear that the use of DEET is a very important technique to prevent these adverse outcomes that we're seeing. So we are encouraging pregnant women to use DEET.
Thank you.
And I did note there is as Dana mentioned, there is the Zika 101 video. There's also one called mosquito prevention video, so you might want to take a look at that and see if that would be of use.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Tamara McDonald, your line is open.
Yes, hello. I just heard about the case in New Jersey this week with the – yes, hello?
We're listening.
Oh, with the case with that pregnant woman. I just wanted to know if you have any thoughts about that. Was her prenatal care overlooked, or was she not aware of the Zika virus in the infant?
So – we don't. It's not really our place to comment on the individual circumstances of that case. We're still performing case investigation to learn more about that case. That was something that came to our attention at the same time it came to the attention of the public. So there's still quite a bit of case investigation ongoing with that case.
Is there a protocol done for prenatal moms that are traveling? Like, what would the first thing be done at their prenatal visit after travel?
So we encourage, right? So in our algorithms, we encourage pregnant women and their healthcare providers to have a discussion about travel history as well as exposure and symptoms that may be associated with Zika virus infection. And we do have both testing available for symptomatic and asymptomatic individuals and different types of tests that can be employed depending upon when the individual is exposed and when they present for care. So we do encourage an evaluation of travel history, exposure history, and symptoms for pregnant women.
Thank you.
Thank you. Naomi Neukamp, your line is open. Excuse me, Naomi. Your line is open.
Hello?
We can hear you now.
Okay. If a pregnant woman gets infected in a later trimester, what are the risks? Are there the same risks? Would it be, not okay, but has there been anything about that?
So we think it's too early to say that infection later on in pregnancy, say in the third trimester, has no risk. We just don't know at this moment. We have a registry that's been established for the 50 states and D.C., as well as a separate registry for Puerto Rico that is collecting information on pregnant women with laboratory evidence of Zika virus infection. And we're hoping through those registries that we can learn more about trimester exposure and how it correlates with outcomes in infants. But at this point, it's premature to say that, if you're in your third trimester, don't worry. I don't think we know that yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. South Carolina DHEC, your line is open.
Hi. I was wondering if there are examples from other states, or if you have examples of states that are high risk for Zika local transmission, that what kind of initiatives are they doing in surrounding family planning and other Zika information?
So some of the states, and I was trying to see if you could see it on that slide. I mean, if you look at the fact sheets that we projected earlier, it lists those initiatives that are available in the various states and which ones are being employed by that particular state. So I don't know what state you're calling from, but if you go to our website and look up the state that you're calling from, you can see which of those initiatives I described are active in your state. And then, of course, there are additional initiatives nationwide that are happening, and we hope to expand those over time.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Daniel Frame. Your line is open.
Yes, hello. Thank you for a great presentation. I'm a part of the National Preconception Health and Healthcare Initiative, and one of the things that we've been wondering whether or not you and the work you're doing are thinking at all about leveraging the media attention and the opportunity of the public's interest in this topic when you talk about the preconception counseling specifically for Zika to tie it to the many other preconception risk factors that can be modified that may be more common and more impactful for women and men to be thinking about prior to pregnancy. It seems like a great opportunity to be able to leverage that attention and focus, and we were wondering whether the CDC or any other groups that are working on this are kind of focused on tying those two concepts together.
I think that's a great point. There are so many things that I think Zika can shed light on as it applies to maternal child health issues, and you've raised a really, really important one. In our tool that we're developing for women interested in conceiving, we're focusing not just on Zika, but mentioning all of the various aspects of preconception counseling. So certainly for that group, using our fact sheet, we're targeting all of the issues that need to be considered. But if you have suggestions on how we can do that better, you know, we'd welcome those.
That's great. We would love to partner with you.
And tell me again, sorry, I didn't catch the organization that you mentioned.
The National Preconception Health and Healthcare Initiative. We do have we have a partnership with the CDC as well.
Okay,
just being
you.
A part of the right conversation.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's Shirley Goody-Hastings, your line is open.
Hi, I have a couple of questions. One is, I noticed the map for the mosquitoes that carry the Zika virus extended into our state, North Carolina, and I wondered if there had been any evidence of mosquitoes that carry it being found in North Carolina. That's one question. And I'm also questioning, is there at any point a woman can be tested for the Zika virus if the baby she's carrying can be tested? And would some women consider a pregnancy termination? And I guess I'm wondering how common is it for a pregnant woman to definitely transmit the virus to the pregnancy? I haven't really heard those stats.
So in terms of your first question, I have to defer to our vector control experts, and I don't know if there are any on the phone that can talk to you about that, but certainly we can get back to you on that question. I just off the top of my head don't know the answer. Do you, Chris?
Yeah, and I think this is Chris Cosmos. I think what I would tell you to do is to contact your state public health department, whether that's environmental health or vector control, and talk to them about the specifics of your state. I think that would be most helpful.
And then in terms of your second question, that you hit the nail on the head. I mean, we don't know the risk of a woman who has Zika virus, what the risk is of her transmitting first the infection to her infant, and secondly, whether that infection, if transmitted to the fetus, would be associated with adverse outcomes, birth defects, et cetera. We really don't know. I think that's what we are trying to capture through the various registries and our collaborative efforts internationally, because that is a critical question that we hear and that we know is popping up all over the country. We just don't know at this moment what that risk is. There have been some modeling studies that are done but we at this point there's no magic number by trimester or overall.
Okay, great. I appreciate the information.
Thank you. At this time, I'm showing no further questions. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1.
And this is Chris Cosmos again. I know we are running over, so apologies for that. We just wanted to make sure we addressed everybody's concerns. But I think, operator, we'll probably make this the last one if there's anything in the queue.
We do have one more question. Pam Griffiths, your line is open.
We wondered in Cortland County if this presentation is going to be archived.
I believe that the presentations will be posted on the Zika website. That's the intent. So if you send us an email of preparedness@cdc.gov, we'll tell you exactly, but the goal is to put them on the Zika website.
Not the presentations then, just the slides?
Just the slides. Oh, you're talking about like a podcast or some sort of recorded?
Right.
Yeah. You know, I don't really know the answer to that right now. I think we'll have to get back to you on that. But the slides are posted and they are in the invitation.
We have those. We thought it would be helpful to show them at a later date with some of the OB offices.
Right. Okay, well, let us figure that out. All right, I think that was the last one, so I want to thank Dana Meany-Delman and John Brooks for two outstanding presentations. Thank you all for your efforts and for dialing in today. We really appreciate your continued interest in this topic. So with that, we will sign off for today. Thank you all very much.
That concludes today's conference call. You may disconnect at this time.